From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
There are a substantial number of voters that voted for Barack Obama twice and then voted for Donald Trump yesterday.
That was the former White House spokesperson Josh Earnest speaking to a reporter on November 9th, 2016, about the results of the presidential election.
And given the vigorous opposition that President-elect Trump professed to have for the Obama agenda, it raises a lot of questions about why those voters supported him. And the answer to that is not obvious to me. Maybe it is to somebody else. And I suspect that political analysts and academics and political professionals, you know, are going to spend days and weeks and months and maybe even years digging into these results and trying to get greater clarity about to explain the outcome. The American people render their judgment, and President Obama doesn't get to choose his successor. The American people do. And they did. And they didn't choose the person that President Obama supported. And so now the responsibility that President Obama has is to turn his attention to prioritizing a smooth transition with his successor and ensuring a peaceful transition of power. But, you know, frankly, the president's aspirations are higher than just a peaceful transition of power. He wants to make sure that we've got an effective transition that gives the next president the opportunity to get a running start. Because now that the election's over, it's a good time to remember that we're Americans first, and all of us are rooting for the success of President Trump as he assumes the awesome responsibility of trying to unite and lead this country.
No serious observer watching what's happened in the United States since November 8th of last year thinks that has happened. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Wednesday.
It's an amazing thing to listen back to November 9th and the message that that the White House, the Obama White House, was then sending to the world, and I guess to the American people, that that we still have a quote-unquote stable democracy, and we're still a nation of laws and not of, quote, men. All of that is being appealed to in Josh Earnest's a response to a kind of hysteria that was sweeping the corporate media at that time. And of course, that hysterical kind of sentiment has been projected to the nation and the world probably ever since Josh Earnest made that statement.
Right.
And so we're where we are now with the whole drama of the alt-right and the Antifa and fighting, you know, in the street. And, you know, we're only a few steps away from becoming Hitler's Germany and all that type of thing. This is all hysteria. Yeah. Which, of course, destabilized, contrary to what Ernst was saying on November 9th, major sections, if not the major parts of the ruling elite in this country, certainly of the political class, have decided for destabilization rather than a normal transfer of power.
Right.
You know, in reality, power was never really transferred.
That's right.
The same people who were in charge on November 8th, 2016, remained in charge, and Trump has found himself increasingly isolated, attempting to make every kind of really contradictory appeal imaginable. On the one side, when he goes to Europe, not very long after his inauguration, he says that he is not comfortable with the way NATO is being run, that the United States has to put itself first over its European allies. He was still talking about the need for rapprochement with Russia at that time. And then, of course, he goes to another extreme with the gesture towards getting tough in Syria with the bombing, the cruise missile
right.
missiles that they lobbed into Syria, which had very little effect.
Right.
But then now the North Korean crisis, which right. I think is completely manufactured.
Agreed.
And here I agree with Stephen Bannon that that's a sideshow, that the real issue is where will the United States empire stand in relationship to an emerging and consolidating China and Asia. So I think that's where we are now. I think this Korean thing is dangerous. The threats and the language coming from Trump himself and from others in his administration is more theater than substance. They cannot, in any rational equation, go to war with North Korea. Certainly, a nuclear attack upon North Korea would devastate the Korean Peninsula because the North would respond by attacking the South. And of course, I think North Korea is probably more prepared, its people, I should say, are more prepared for war than either South Korea, Japan, or even the United States.
For sure.
So it is a war that we could only get in by huge missteps and mistakes by people who take this rhetoric more seriously than it should be taken. However, the policy of appeasement of the Chinese and Russians does not deter aggression. It only encourages it. So I think that's where we are right now.
Yeah, let's be clear. What you're talking about, I assume, is Russia and China appeasing a belligerent United States and not U.S.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, to be clear on that. So
absolutely.
You know, I mean,
and
look,
and allowing the Security Council of the United Nations to be used at least to create an atmosphere where it is North Korea that is the aggressor.
Yeah.
When in effect, it is the United States who are interested in repartitioning Asia and creating zones of control and influence in the wake of, in the face of the surging Chinese political economy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the main competitor. They're very clear about what their intentions are, been stated by, so many of them that, the PNAC group, all of them, any rising competitor is to be suffocated in the cradle.
That's right. That's right.
I think
Steve Bannon has helped us to understand just what the struggle is within the White House, within the Trump administration, and really at another level, what the struggle between the Trump White House and what we call the deep state is. And this contradiction or these contradictions have to be factored in to any realistic assessment of what the overall political situation is in the country, where the vortex of the struggle is, what we have to do moving forward. I think if we understand more accurately, more objectively, what is going on at the level of the ruling class, I think we can better answer the question of what is to be done going forward. And it is not Antifa. It is not the street battles between the alt-right and Antifa. This is a distraction, a pure distraction. The struggle is not about Confederate statues. The struggle, first and primarily, is about the struggle against war and for peace, first on the Korean Peninsula. I think we have to use as a model of negotiation and so on the START treaties, the Strategic Arms Reduction treaties between the Soviet Union and the United States going back to the 1970s. We have to use that as a model. All of this belligerency and threat and the U.S. and South Korea and Japan carrying out military exercises around and over the skies of North Korea, the threats coming from Trump and others in the deep state is not the answer. War, as I've said before, war on the Korean Peninsula would be a disaster, not only for Korea, but it would be a disaster for the global economy and for Northeast Asia.
Yeah, and perhaps for the entire planet.
I think you're right. You know? That's right.
We're talking about the possibility. I mean, first of all, talking about conducting a war on the border of Russia and China. Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't find a worse spot on the planet with a map
Absolutely.
In your hand in terms of the international situation. And mm-hmm. just yesterday at the United Nations, the China's permanent representative said, look, for everything else that's going on, this intimidation, the installation of this THAAD missile system, this is destabilizing to the whole global geopolitical situation. It's not just about Korea. And, you know, stop doing it. And, we're not seeing, Nikki Haley did not seem deterred by that at all. I mean, she spoke before China's permanent representative, but there's been no acknowledgement of the fact that, look, we have to walk gingerly through this and be discreet and, agile and, work in the realm of political rather than military at all. I mean, they're playing tough guy like crazy. Now, I don't know. Is that more for domestic consumption while they try to make, because Trump said yesterday while he was standing with the Finnish president, that we should and will have peace with Russia or good relations with Russia. You know, he said it affirmatively just yesterday after, the last period from November 9th until, this morning hasn't resembled, on the ground running, but rather kneecapping him so that he can't even walk. And yet he still, and that's the big issue, is the relationship with Russia in particular. And yet he's still affirmatively stating that good relations with Russia, not only possible, but they will happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's positive, and that's one of the most positive features of his political campaign, raising the prospect of a rapprochement, a détente with Russia. Now, of course, to achieve that, he had to go up against a momentum of encircling Russia, which has not been broken or slowed down since the election. Stephen A. Cohen and other observers of the U.S.-Russia relationship over decades have said that this movement of troops and NATO right up to the borders of Russia is provocation and can only lead to a serious disaster for Europe and the world. That having been said, I don't think that Trump can play two sides, riding two horses in opposite directions. You can't be for peace with Russia and have all this belligerent talk about North Korea. If you want rapprochement with Russia, you should also want rapprochement with North Korea, and it is negotiable.
And Iran, too. Iran also the same.
Of course, Iran, too. You know what I'm saying? But since the flashpoint right now, at least in political rhetoric, is North Korea and so on, that, what we have to demand on the ground going forward, and our political education of the people must insist upon this, that there are no military options to the resolution of any international or global problems. And more than that, the more the United States focuses upon war and threat against Iran or North Korea or anywhere else, the less attention is paid to the pressing needs of the American people to rebuild the economy, to create good jobs, to educate the people, to rebuild the system of education, public education, including higher education. I mean, these are pressing issues. And all of this talk of war is a diversion from these issues. If Trump is about imperial retreat, and I think it is not just a rational choice, but it is an inevitable reality. The United States cannot pursue hegemonistic policies on a global scale to establish a 21st century Pax Americana. That is off the table, and events have put that off the table. We focus upon the rise of China, the One Belt, One Road policy, the soft diplomacy and economic policies in Africa and Asia, and even reaching towards Europe of China. This means that China is a pivotal player, but not the only player. The breaking of the 25-year Pax Americana, the triumphalism that came after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that period is over. And unfortunately, the U.S. political class does not have a clue and therefore cannot unify itself over where do we go from here. I think, and this is, I guess, just a suggestion, that they take a page out of Britain after World War II. They could not hold on to India. They had to retreat from their colonial hold or grip in this huge country in Asia, and then eventually of their colonies in Africa. A retreat, the United States, I think, has to come to the conclusion that we're in a new world, a different world, and all of the rules that came into play after the collapse of the Soviet Union are no longer viable in this situation.
Yeah. You know, they are clearly not prepared for you know, what has happened, not just the election of Trump, but it was obvious there. That press conference at the White House, you know, there was a regularly scheduled press conference that they held at the White House with Josh Earnest. The reporters there were shocked. You know, these are people that cover the White House every day. They are the most sophisticated journalists, quote unquote, around all of that. That our, you know, our journalism industry produces. These are the people that are right next to the president, and they presumably know more about what's going on in politics than anybody else in the country. That's what they're supposed to be doing as mediators of what's happening to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And they were totally caught off guard and emotionally devastated, mm-hmm. as if they were lost, like something had happened and we don't know who to follow anymore. And you can see that kind of, you know, Earnest had more balance in his, it's like his psychic state, I guess, while he was responding. But you could see that he said himself, like, hey, look, nobody expected this. The pollsters didn't expect it. The president didn't expect it. I didn't expect it. We weren't prepared for this. We don't know. But what we got to do is hand it over and make it work for the next guy. That's essentially what he was saying. This kind of permeates the whole, I think, state of the elites here, not just that election. You know, the collapse in 2008 caught a lot of them off guard. The you know, inability to sort of rebound from that, and then the inability to maintain political control with the deteriorating situation here and in Europe with austerity and all this, that, you know, we own the media. How come we can't convince everybody to be happy just because they're not eating?
Right.
There's a lot of that going on.
I think you describe things quite accurately, and I agree with you that much of what we saw in 2016 and are seeing up to this moment goes back to the financial collapse and the recession that followed it in 2008, or some people would say 2007. And the collapse of one of the major Wall Street financial houses, Lehman Brothers, and the fact that the entire financial system globally was threatened. Now, of course, they've kind of pieced it back together, but on the backs of working people. And the masses of people in the United States and Europe are poorer and in a more precarious position today than they were in 2008, which is part of why the electorate, either by voting for Trump or staying at home, passed judgment and made their voices heard and their dissatisfaction known in respect to what was this 8 years of austerity and a loss of jobs and loss of homes and with no prospect of things getting better for them.
Right.
And that is still the mood in the country, in spite of the distractions of the alt-right and this Antifa and Black Bloc kind of street fighting, which is really some very poor example of serious street fighting. Neither side seems to be able to fight for real.
Come hang on the blocks we had to grow up on. Yeah, right.
Can we talk? I can show you street fighting.
I can show you some scars, okay?
But so this is a distraction. The economic needs of the masses of people are still should be at the center of all discussions as to fascism. And I said it many, many times. The Antifa are not keeping the fascists off of the streets or out of government. They're already in government.
Right.
They're already in the street by much of what we see on local police forces. The national security state is a reality, and what Edward Snowden showed us about the monitoring of the 300 or more million people in the United States. Our thought is controlled through a corporate media that has shut down any form of criticism. So I don't know what the alt-right could do that is not already being done.
Yeah.
As to this renewed consciousness of the fight against white supremacy, I find it quite ironic that many people just discovered white supremacy when Trump was elected. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
So this has to be a street theater for the sake of distracting attention from the pressing issues of our time. And those issues are peace and economic development and growth within the country. Peace and jobs, peace, jobs, and justice. And these street fights do not raise any of these issues, but turn to Confederate statues as symbols of through which we express our anger at Trump and his voters.
Yeah, it seems that the march towards war, in essence,
yeah,
continues unless there's a real public grappling with the question of American hegemony and militarism and the question of white supremacy at home cannot be grappled with or even considered without dealing simultaneously with and understanding fully the relationship between that and imperialism.
That's right. I think you're so right. And so, in spite of all that's going on, the distractions and so on, those of us who understand these things have to continue to talk and fight and hopefully make an impact in the thinking of millions of people with respect to what must be done. And that's what we're talking about. What is to be done?
That's right.
You know, Chris Hedges had a very interesting essay on his website, Truth Dig, where he excoriated the alt-left and Antifa in particular. And what he said was, and I think he made some mistakes in his logic, but the substance of his position was that the people, it would appear, who are demonstrating on both sides of this small drama, the Antifa and the alt-right, are those who have been left behind in an economy that benefits a very, very small part of the American people. The alt-right is made up of unemployed, for the most part, or people who are in a precarious economic condition, as does Antifa, young people who've graduated from college, many of them, who can't find jobs, who have this huge debt, who do not have a future. So they fight each other rather than trying to find a point of unity or points of unity to fight the ruling class. And believe me, again, Steve Bannon is accurate in his interview, right before he was let go from the White House.
The American Spectator, yeah, right.
The American Spectator, where he made it clear, and he's right, that that is a sideshow, that the so-called alt-right is a joke, and a huge joke. Yep. And I would say, like Chris Hedges says, in a lot of ways, Antifa is a joke.
Yep.
And so, yeah, here we are. If the left, and here I have to put quotes, did one thing, it could make a difference. 80% or something close to that of counties, white counties, that voted for Obama in 2012, voted for Trump in 2016. Okay. That should tell us something. Those people represent a constituency, a potential constituency for the message of the left. As you say, peace and jobs and justice. But rather than turn to them, it seems that the corporate media is encouraging a type of satirical, sectarian movement to represent the left. I mean, that's why the New York Times embraces Antifa. And it is taking us away from the principal questions. I'm very interested, since it's not in the media these days, what has happened to the Mueller investigation into Russia's hacking into our election? Why is that no longer on the front pages? Could it have something to do with Representative Dana Rohrabacher's meeting with Julian Assange, that three-hour meeting?
That's right.
Where he said that Julian Assange assured him that he is prepared to come to the United States and reveal what the source of their getting the DNC emails, which was so damaging to the Clinton campaign. Where did it come from? And he said he's prepared to come here. That has not been discussed. Why has the political narrative shifted so quickly and suddenly from Russiagate, so-called, to now fighting white supremacy and fascism?
Thank you very much, Professor Montero. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, sir.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.